The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, our affiliate stations, or CJSR.
Hello, people. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Skeptically Speaking is the show that usually asks you to call in and question everything, but not today. This episode has been pre-recorded, as I am currently in Atlanta, Georgia at DragonCon, the world's largest fantasy and science fiction convention. It's basically ground zero for nerdery of all kinds. I'll be attending the SkepTrack, which is the skeptical stream of the con, and features presentations from so many amazing skeptics that I won't even attempt to list them all. In addition to that, I'll be stalking William Shatner, but only a little, not enough that someone will have to come and bail me out of jail. Now, speaking of skeptical gatherings, I met today's guest at the Amazing Meeting, the other bastion of skeptical goodness. It's an annual event hosted by the James Randi Educational Foundation and is an all-around good time for many reasons. One of the best ones is meeting other people doing interesting things and coercing them into appearing on your show. And one of those people is Kennedy Goodkey, writer, actor, producer of the new movie, The Beast of Bottomless Lake. He's an outspoken skeptic, and the film is about Ogopogo. We'll be talking to him a little later on. As usual, we'll start with some speaking up. We're on the line with K.O. Myers, the founder of the brand spanking new skeptical organization, Grassroots Skeptics. Hi, K.O.
Hello, Desiree.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good, thanks for being here.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So, Grassroots Skeptics, tell us all about it.
Well, I want to start off with a question, and I know you have people listening on the radio and streaming online and people listening to the podcast, so it's sort of all over the place, and I sort of want to ask all of them, is there an active skeptical group meeting in your area? Now, if you said yes right away, that's great. It's great that there's a group you have access to. It's great you know the group is there. Hopefully, you're actually participating in your local group's activities, but that's a separate topic. If you said no right away, that's not quite so great, but there are some positive things that can be taken away from that. Again, it means you're aware of what is or isn't available in your backyard, and that's an important first step. It also means that you have the opportunity, if you want it, to take the initiative and start a group of your own. Now, that's more work, obviously, than just showing up to a meeting once a month, but you get to make decisions, which is always cool. You can decide what kind of group you want to start, how to structure it, what kind of events you want to throw, whether your meetings have a drink minimum, all kinds of stuff. And in a movement that's populated with so many eager individuals, being the person who steps up and gets the ball rolling can often be enough to build a community pretty quickly. Where I think that skepticism as a movement kind of runs into a problem, even more for folks who say that there isn't a group in their area, is with people who wind up saying that they don't know. There are dozens of, maybe hundreds of skeptical groups active literally all around the world. And so there are all these groups out there, and more of them are appearing all the time. And I think that among the daily issues of setting up meetings, finding venues, picking discussion topics, I think we sometimes as organizers don't do as good a job as we could of promoting ourselves. And we aren't so hot at coordinating our efforts. Mm-hmm. Again, I think a lot of that is that each time a new group starts up, the people making the decisions have so many other things to think about. I also think that we're talking about generally smart, opinionated people. And I think that skeptical activists, we're sometimes guilty of thinking that we can do it all on our own and we don't need any help. But I think more than any of that, there really isn't any kind of structure to facilitate that kind of coordination. So as a result, each new group kind of winds up reinventing the wheel. Now, for the most part, they do a great job, but I still feel like we're living in the information age. Why can't we be sharing blueprints so that the next person who comes along doesn't have to start from scratch? So that's where I hope that Grassroots Skeptics can kind of step into the breach. I think what I'd like to do is create a hub where folks can share successful group models, get advice from folks who've already done it, and where established groups can share discussion topics, get feedback about ideas they want to try. And also, then we can make it easier for folks who want to join a group to find out who's meeting near them. Or if it turns out they're in an area without a group, then maybe they'll be able to look at a bunch of different ways they can start their own group. So hopefully we'll be able to assist people, no matter how they answered that initial question, with hooking up with a skeptical group and helping established groups recruit members and find resources.
Awesome. That's brilliant. Yay.
Thanks.
But those are some good questions, and I assume that you've asked them of people.
And are those answers that you received sort of what inspired you to do this?
Well, there's kind of a long answer and a short answer. And the long answer is that I just graduated from law school, and I just finished studying for the bar exam, and I kind of have been getting more involved in skepticism and sort of realizing this was my general outlook in life for a couple of years now. And I finally had a little bit of time on my hands, and I've been discussing the whole thing with my wife, who's very smart and very science-minded, but doesn't really feel like she has an entry into skepticism. And we have a very young daughter. And so a lot of the sort of meeting space out there tends to be very much kind of, let's go to a bar and have a couple of drinks and discuss skepticism. And so I was sort of looking for a way to maybe promote more of an entry for people like her into the movement. And the short answer is that I was surprised that someone wasn't already doing it. Like I went online to see, is there any place where local groups can share ideas? And there really wasn't. And it just sort of, I decided, well, I have some talent hopefully for organizing information and making it accessible. So this is something that I can do to go beyond sort of writing on my blog and talking to other people and maybe turn it into more of an outreach kind of thing.
But Grassroots Skeptics isn't just an event calendar, right? Although that's an important part of getting us organized.
Right. Yeah, it is. And we're actually doing an events calendar in conjunction with skepchick.org. So you will be able to go and look up specific events, but it is more about that. It's about kind of getting an index of groups out there. So if you're in a particular city, you want to find out what groups you have. You don't have to just, be at the mercy of Google. There's one place you can go and look up, okay, I'm in Phoenix. I want to see if there's a group near me. Click, click, here it is. Okay. Or if there isn't a group in your area, then you can go and you can talk to people who have already established groups and get some tips or some tricks or look at a couple of different models. There are different types of groups. There's the drinking skeptically model, but there are other types of things that people who meet in different venues do different types of discussions. And, you can get a little different perspective on that. So it's not just about what events are there, but it's about how can I hook up with other groups and how can I share information and how can I and if you have a group, are you ready to take the step from just doing discussions to maybe doing community outreach?
Right.
And how can I learn from the experience of people who already started doing that?
So eventually this is going to be the one-stop shop for how to build your own skeptical group.
That would be ideal. It's obviously a long-term goal. There's definitely a lot of information out there, and there are a lot of people who are sort of doing it on the ground. And it's going to take a while to sort of gather all their perspectives, because I really do want to try and get as many voices involved as I can. There are groups and organizations out there doing sort of activism on dozens of different topics and dozens of different ways of going about it. So I really want to try and get as much of that together as possible so that people can find something that's really suited to the things that they need in their area.
Will there be perhaps downloadable resources and templates and such? I'm just thinking things like simple sign-up lists for meetings or checklists for running events.
Sure. Yeah. That's something that we're working on down the road, getting the forms like that, which can be so time consuming to put together. If we put one together and save it as a Word document or something or an Excel file that can be tweaked for particular needs. Yeah, that's we can do that once and then they don't have to start from scratch when they're ready to do it. That's definitely something that we are looking into doing.
This sounds like a big job.
Yeah.
And you understand that organizing skeptics is similar to the herding of the cats.
Yes, I have heard that. And, it's true in a sense. There are a lot of really strong individuals and strong personalities and strong opinions. But there's also a real sense of people wanting something like this and wanting to help make it happen. I've approached a few different people. I'm working with a couple of people. Chelsea Epperson and Jen Myers from Skeptic are involved in helping put our new website together and in getting sort of the data entry stuff involved, gathering the information and getting it in there. I've had contact with dozens of different people, bloggers and podcasters, about publicity for the website launch, and just about across the board, the response has been, that's great. How can I help? You know, there really is, there really are the people who are involved really do want to, they really are really open with their time and their energy.
And are you looking for more people to get involved?
We are. We're still filling out the contours past, you know, the big thing is, like I said, the big thing is the website launch. We're going to go live with forums and an index of all the groups we've been able to find. So we want to get people involved initially, kind of having discussions in the forums, and hopefully we can guide the discussion there. But there is definitely going to be need down the road for people to do sort of real world projects. And we have on the website, we have a sign up sheet where you can leave, if you're an individual, you can leave contact information and you know, let us know some ways you'd be willing to help. If you run a skeptical group there, you can also let us know. If your group doesn't appear in our index, you can let us know where you are, who you are, how to get in touch with you. And if you are interested in starting a group, you can let us know that too, and we can get in touch with you.
Perfect. So where can people find you?
At grassrootsskeptics.org. We're also on Twitter at GRSkeptics. We have a Facebook page. And I think there are a couple other social networking things. But it's all available on the website. And I think it's all in one place, too. So it's we're starting the organization on our own doorstep, so to speak.
Perfect. Well, thanks very much for being here, KO.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks, actually, very much for starting up this organization, because there's definitely a gap here. And it's nice that someone stepped up to fill it.
Well, you're welcome. I mean, I hope... I don't know if I'm exactly the man for the job, but I'm sort of the first one who got to it. So I'm going to do my best.
Yeah, sometimes that's all it takes. So if you want to talk about your own skeptical initiatives, email feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put speaking up in the subject line, tell us what you want to talk about, and we'll contact you. And we'll be right back with Kennedy Goodkey to discuss Ogopogo, being a skeptical actor, and why skeptics in movies are always pretentious people that no one likes, right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. And contrary to that ad, please don't call or email, as this is a pre-taped episode. We're here with BC writer and actor Kennedy Goodkey. He's best known for his work in independent Vancouver theater and his many years spent on the Fringe Festival theater circuit. He was the winner of the first national sketchwriting competition and is a principal in the Vancouver production company Provost Pictures. As an actor, Kennedy has appeared in The L Word and The Sons of Cohen, for which he also wrote the screenplay. He was the first recipient of the Provost Writers Award for his play Sarcophagus about the Chernobyl disaster. And as a writer, Kennedy's credits include the animated films A David Lynch Family Christmas and The Gnome Who Knew Too Much, which was the winner of the Special Achievement Award at the 2003 Real Fast 48-Hour Filmmaking Competition. He also wrote the live-action short Rewind and the shorts Godot and Straight Flush, which he also directed. And now he's written and is appearing in and has produced a new independent film by the name of The Beast of Bottomless Lake. Kennedy, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, Des, my pleasure. My God, my bio is so long-winded all of a sudden.
Did you write your own Wikipedia article?
I don't think you're allowed to, actually. I noticed one day I had a Wikipedia bio when I was Googling myself, how narcissistic. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have to check this out. And there it was.
And they haven't removed it. How long has it been there?
Ooh, over a year.
That means you're important.
Yeah, I guess so.
So tell us a bit about Ogopogo, the creature your film was based on.
The Ogopogo, well, it's, I mean, the simplest way to put it is it's Canada's Loch Ness Monster. It lives, allegedly, in Lake Okanagan, which is quite a large lake in British Columbia, which people may or may not be familiar with. I mean, the lake, not British Columbia. I'm hoping people know British Columbia.
We have a lot of American listeners.
Oh, a lot of American listeners. I forget about that. Right. Well, in any case, British Columbia is above Seattle, for those who do not know. And I'm way off subject here, aren't I? You're going to have to get used to broad tangents while you got me on the line. Yeah, it's a say, 30 to 80 foot serpentine or possibly plesiosaur lake monster.
How is this different than the Loch Ness Monster? Is there really any difference, or is it like the same kind of stories are told about both of these legendary creatures?
The similarities are pretty remarkable. Well, or not remarkable, depending on how you look at it, because they all come from the same imaginary space. The history of sightings is very similar. The quality of evidence is similar. Similarly bad. And yeah, and most of the actual stories about what it looks like are pretty much the same, regardless of whether you're talking about the Loch Ness or the Ogopogo.
Right, so these could easily be attributed to things like trees.
Trees floating in the water.
Otters, perhaps.
Otters are the big ones. Beavers ferrying logs. Boat wakes or standing waves in the water. Both lakes are really quite long and narrow, so they have a quite a long fetch, so they can develop quite significant waves over the length of them. Not big enough to surf on, but certainly substantial compared to your average sized lake.
Now, this has been going on for years, these sightings.
Absolutely.
And are there still sightings today?
Yes, there are. Gosh, it was very recently I read about, there were a pair of sightings in very short order, one of which was an actual sighting, so to speak. Someone who was in a lake, I'm going to get the story wrong because I didn't pay too much attention to it, honestly. Somebody was swimming in the lake and something swam near them and they decided it was the Ogopogo, although the people who saw it in that case were pretty... they were pretty hesitant to label it the Ogopogo, but the advocates in the region definitely leapt upon it being the Ogopogo very quickly. And the other case was somebody found the body of something washed up on the lake and immediately assumed it was the Ogopogo. And yeah, and that's where that story went, generally speaking.
What did it turn out to be?
You know, I actually don't know what it turned out to be. I think a sample was taken of the flesh, if I'm not mistaken, and I believe it was actually given to Arlene Gall, who's kind of the world's credulous expert on the Ogopogo.
Right.
And you know, if you want a scientific opinion, that's not who you go to. The credulous, you go to somebody who doesn't have a vested interest. So I don't really know what happened with that. I'm sure I could probably figure it out on the internet fairly quickly. I should have looked that up this afternoon knowing I was going to be talking to you.
Well, I just wonder about stuff like that because it's so often that even in Edmonton, somebody thought that a human hand was thrown in a dumpster. And, you know, big outcry, lots of panic, whatever. But it turns out it was a bear paw. And apparently when the bear paw rots away, the nails look just like the last little bone on fingers. And it looks very much like a human hand.
Interesting.
So I'm wondering what someone would mistake for the body of Ogopogo.
Yeah, well, I think it could have easily been something like
a cow.
A cow, a deer, you know, a deer tries to swim across the lake and doesn't make it and gets washed up after, you know, X amount of time. And Lord knows what's happened to it in the way of carrion fish that have fed upon it and so forth
mm-hmm, exactly.
by the time it's washed up. So it could be absolutely unrecognizable as what it actually was. And I think the fact that we never heard anything more about it in the ensuing 6 weeks or whatever it's been, and here we are months later, we haven't heard anything about it. So I'm right. guessing that it wasn't something right. that would change the way we look at the world.
Tell us about the film. What's the premise?
The premise, well, it's a comedy, ultimately, which is going to play against what I say next, which is that it's a modern update of Moby Dick, with the Ogopogo as the great white whale, and the heroes are sort of what you might imagine an adult's group of, the Scooby-Doo gang grown-up might be.
Okay, you know, and having seen the movie, I can buy that.
Yeah, that makes sense to you?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm very hesitant to talk about movies because I hate spoilers. I hate them. So I'm going to try not to touch on it too much, but I do find it interesting that a skeptic yourself wrote and acted in a movie that has some distinctly not-so-skeptical bits in it. Do you want to tell us about that?
Sure. Well, for starters, I found that I think I'm somebody who can claim to have been a skeptic or developing towards skepticism all their life. But really, I was not introduced to the formal skeptic community until after the film had been shot. So when I look at the film now, I'm pretty proud of how much I got right as far as the formal arguments of things go. Not being able to prove a negative and failing to think of other examples at the moment. But they're there. And going to TAM and showing the putting it in front of an audience there as a test, using them as a test audience, was a pretty freaky thing for me. That was the litmus test in a way. I was putting this film in front of the demographic that I was most wanting to enjoy it, but also most scared of the reaction.
Right.
And I mean, you were there in the room. I think it was. I can justifiably say that we passed the test.
You absolutely did, and everybody very much enjoyed it. And
yeah.
there was pretty hardcore skeptics in that room, really.
Yes.
So what did the other actors on the set think of the legend?
I think, for the most part, they were all fairly... I'm totally assuming this, though, that they were all largely in line with my basic position that there is no 40-foot serpent that lives in Lake Okanagan. The degree to which they have a vehement opinion about that might vary, but if they did have an opinion other than that, nobody actually voiced it to me. This is one of the subjects that is more low-hanging fruit in the skeptical community.
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it. Okay, well, this question was sent to us before the show, and listeners, thank you so much. People who use that that little question box we recently added to the website, we very much appreciate it. So this one asks, being a skeptic, how difficult was it for you to take your role seriously when I assume that some actors had to find a way to believe in Ogopogo in order to be convincing with their characters?
Well, I can really only answer that for myself, and I, in the film... play the most skeptical character in the film. And to the point where we actually had to pull it back in the editing because it was too much.
Really?
He went, oh yeah, oh yeah. He was, he was a bit of a jerk about it at times. He was a bit of an a-hole if you want to go that far.
I thank you for respecting the American listeners who aren't allowed to hear swears.
Aww,
Canadians are
so
allowed
sad.
To hear swears. Sorry, go ahead.
So it was pretty easy for me to buy into that that reality, because it really was my reality. I was bringing that part of myself to the role as the primary distinguishing characteristic of the character. So you might have, I mean, unfortunately he's not here, but you might have to ask David Nickel, who's our star in the film, plays our equivalent of Ahab. What he thought of the film. And you know what? I think you're going to Dragon Con, aren't you?
I am.
You know, you might stumble upon him there.
Oh, he'll be there.
I believe he's going to be there. I might be wrong about that, but I believe he's going to be there with other Stargate Atlantis folk.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Don't even get me started about Dragon Con right now. Okay.
Oh, but you're actually at Dragon Con right now, aren't
right,
you?
Right, at this very moment. Oh, it's like time travel.
Yes.
Okay. Actually, we have another audience question as well.
Excellent.
Was your skepticism helpful on this project, or did you find that it sometimes got in the way of your creativity or the creativity of the other cast and crew members?
Ah, okay. Was my skepticism okay? Yes, it certainly was. Like I said earlier, I hadn't really formalized my skeptical worldview by when I was writing it, but we actually had to, like, our both of our story editors had to tell me as we were writing the script that I needed to cut back a little bit and allow the story to A, have a satisfying conclusion, and B, a little more open to interpretation.
So what was the budget of the film?
The budget of the film, well, there's different ways of answering that. Cash money spent was less than $40,000. Now, if you add up all the things that we got for free, and actually I haven't done a specific tally of this just because I don't want to scare myself, with all the free labor we got, and when I say free, that meant, I mean, we sold the back-end profits of the film. So people will be getting a share of this film in perpetuity for as long as it continues to be sold.
Absolutely.
But if we'd paid people, then we'd easily have spent well over $250,000 making this movie.
Well, was it hard to
find... Which would still be pretty cheap.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But was it hard to find financial backers for this kind of a movie?
Yes and no. I don't know if you know the tale about how we got started. In 2005, I believe, Craig, my co-producer, and I decided, okay, let's make this thing. We had written the script with another actor who passed away. And we decided, okay, let's make this for Keith. And we decided the way to do that was to see if we could sell producer credits on eBay. And
wow.
Yeah, so we did an auction, and we sold three with three different auctions. We didn't make a lot of money at that, but we got various bits of press attention from coast to coast. We were front of the entertainment page of the Globe and Mail. Oh, you know what? It was later that happened. I'm lying. We were front of the entertainment page for the Globe and Mail, but that was not for the eBay thing. But if it wasn't for the eBay auction, this movie would have never been made. If it wasn't for the attention we got from that, we wouldn't have had any sort of forward momentum from which we could have got the various bits and bobs of money that we got in order to make it in the first place.
So the movie was filmed in Kelowna.
Right.
How long were you there?
We were in the Okanagan for 2.5 weeks. We shot 2.5 weeks in Kelowna and then came back and split the rest of the production schedule in Vancouver.
What was it like to film a monster movie in a town where the tourist industry is based on keeping that monster alive?
It was good for the most part. We the city of Kelowna in particular, the Okanagan in general, did a whole lot of bending over back for us. A lot of the free stuff and cheap stuff that we got because they were excited about the fact that we were shooting a movie about their monster in their city.
Right.
And it wasn't a documentary like everything else that has ever been, you know, has been. You know, Kelowna was playing itself for the first time in a film. It had been used when Fido, the zombie film, shot there. But of course, it wasn't Kelowna then. There was another one, I'm forgetting the name of it, Magic in the Water, I think, film about the Ogopogo, which was shot in Australia. So I think I might have my facts wrong there, but it's something like that. So yeah, so this is the first time somebody was coming to film their monster in their place.
So they were really receptive to that?
They were for the most part. I mean, I had to do a certain amount of being diplomatic. I think most people there don't believe in the Ogopogo, but they can't come out and say that. It would be, I don't know, like some kind of sacrilege for them to say, oh, yes, our tourist mascot is not real. It's just a cartoon.
Exactly. So how much of their livelihood do you think is actually built around Ogopogo? Like, are there Ogopogo memorabilia shops, Ogopogo restaurants, truck stops, perhaps?
All over. There's an Ogopogo automotive that I have a picture of. Just in the news today, in my news feed, something came up about a place called Ogopogo Boat Rentals or Sales or something like that. So yeah, the entire city is infused, the region is infused with Ogopogo lore. They're proud, I guess, of it. And I think if Ogopogo disappeared tomorrow, if the legend was wiped off the face of the planet, Kelowna's tourism industry would do just fine. They wouldn't have quite the same hook anymore, there's no doubt, but it's a gorgeous place. They're always going to be able to get people to come up and, you know, hang out on the shore of the lake.
It is a gorgeous town, definitely.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Well, actually, there's a question relating to this that was sent in via the website. Whenever I see people making money off of pseudoscience and the paranormal, I always wonder whether they truly believe their own sales pitch. Presumably, some are delusional and others deceptive. I have no idea which category is bigger. Do Mr. Goodkey's experiences in Ogopogo shed any light? Thanks, Chris. And that's from Chris from the Business Ethics blog.
Wicked. Thanks, Chris. Well, I think there's one other category, at least in the case of Ogopogo, that he's missing out on. It's sort of a subcategory, I guess, of those who are willfully making money knowing that what they're hawking is garbage. And that's people who are kind of winking at it at the same time. Like I said earlier, there's a lot of, you know, in the Okanagan, the Ogopogo has kind of been reduced to being a cartoon. It's quit being this native legend and has turned into this, you know, goofy, happy, fun serpent. And there are all sorts of people, we feature a bunch of them in one scene in the film, who have made all kinds of things, you know, whether it's stuffed toys or funny t-shirts, or in one case, this is one of my favorites, there's a pair of sisters who have started making candy that they call Ogopogo poop, which they sell. So they aren't serious. It's not Ogopogo down there selling, and nobody... You know, they're not really trying to pull one over on anybody. They're just kind of having a fun go at it. But as far as the people who are delusional and those who are more willfully taking advantage of those who are credulous, again, I think they're probably fairly balanced. I think the people who are making money off of it are generally speaking, if they don't fall into the category of winking at it, they are people who really are delusional and actually believe that somehow there's enough fish in this lake to feed a family of serpents.
Well, could you tell who the real believers were?
Yes. Not universally. We did a series of interviews during one of our first scouting trips. We stopped people and talked to them about it on camera. And it was amazing how many of them, when we asked, do you believe in the Ogopogo, it would stop them short. They would hesitantly say yes. But and in my interpretation of the subtext in all those cases was that these were people who were just weren't willing to say no on camera.
Right.
But yes, there definitely are some people. There was only one who I talked to face-to-face. I talked to a couple on the phone. But in my research, there was only one person who I ever talked to who I really felt as though he genuinely believed in the Ogopogo. And this is a lousy story, actually, because I can't remember his name and I can't even remember what it was about him that made me feel that way.
Right.
Well, sorry.
Did anyone think that you were making fun of them?
Yes, absolutely. There were some people who had their, you know, their blast shields up. But I think that they were greatly outweighed by the people who were just happy that we were kind of trying to tell a little part of their story in some twisted way.
Mm. Well, I could be pulling this out of nowhere, honestly. But were there by any chance more belief-based stores there than other places? Like more New Age stores or more churches? Because there was a study done a while back about the 9/11 truth movement regarding how people that believe in one conspiracy tend to believe in more than one.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm just wondering if that translates here at all. Like, were there an excess of crystal shops?
Not that I noticed, but I really, you know, my focus on was on, okay, that scene's done. What's next?
Right. Okay, so... Now, I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but do you feel like making a movie like this could be dangerous? Because you're publicizing Ogopogo, right?
Right.
So what if some people in your audience start to put some stock in it? You know, it's a good movie. They could end up going home after the movie thinking, well, maybe there is something to that legend. Like, is it possible that you're doing skepticism a disservice?
Yeah. Well, that's why I was so concerned about going to TAM and showing it there. But I had to know. And I mean, certainly I didn't get an answer to that specifically at TAM. But I think I got the message that we as a community aren't concerned about it. That we all sort of collectively, we know that, yeah, this is a piece of fiction. You know, people don't come back from Star Wars thinking that spaceships make noise in space. Well, some people do. But, you know, nobody really thinks that James Earl Jones is Mark Hamill's dad.
This is a good point.
Yeah.
And nice illusion. You do know this audience. And on that note...
Hey, I am this audience. Come on.
On that note, we are going to go to a break, and we will be right back.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking to Richard Saunders, paranormal investigator and reporter and host of Skeptizone Podcast. Richard will explain how we can properly use the scientific method to test psychic and supernatural claims, how to research objectively, how to become a credible resource for mainstream news, and how to keep a straight face, even, and especially, when it's difficult. Call in and question everything on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. We're here with Kennedy Goodkey, writer, actor, producer, and all-around opinionated skeptic. We're talking about his new independent movie, The Beast of Bottomless Lake, and about entertainment and skepticism in general. So, would you say that the entertainment industry leans more towards the credulous or incredulous?
Wow. I think I have to say more towards the credulous, but there's certainly, I mean, I can't paint it all with one brush, obviously. One of my fellow co-stars, for example, in Beast, is actually someone who shows up occasionally at our Vancouver Skeptics in the Pub.
Wonderful.
So, yeah. And also, I think that generally speaking, it depends on what people are doing. Like in the film industry, technicians tend to be science-minded. Or camera people or whatever, they've got a geeky mind which leads them towards the science. And I think, you know, we see that in our own community with people like the Mythbusters. What did they do originally? Special effects. But yes, there are a lot of new age people on the creative end of the equation. Not so much believers in, well, creationists and that sort of thing, although occasionally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, new age subjects in particular, we are awash and woo in the creative industry.
Well, and you know, because I was thinking it could go either way. You know, with all the pretending that you do for a living, it could easily drift into real belief. And of course, I'm speaking of actors here. Mm-hmm. But that could also just lead to cynicism.
Yes, it could. Yeah, I don't know where to go from that, Des. I think you said it.
Well, I also wonder, you know, you are in Vancouver, and I don't know how different the industry is in Vancouver as it is in other places, but Vancouver is a somewhat spiritually based place.
Yes, it is. I think the cliches of the West Coast, whether it's, you know, Los Angeles or Vancouver, we are kind of hippy-dippy, and it's really frustrating at times. You know, I can walk up to the end of my street, and there is a store which it's not just a naturopathy store, it is an actual homeopathy store right at the end of the street from where I live.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I lived in Vancouver, so I can feel your pain, and I love the Vancouver Skeptics. I think you guys are doing a fantastic job out there.
I hope so.
Yeah, because really, energy and crystals and fairies, oh my. Here's another website question. I've heard about superstitions in theater, like saying break a leg instead of good luck, or the Scottish play instead of Macbeth. Do TV and film actors have their own superstitions? How seriously do people take these beliefs anyway?
Well, I think there is only the finest of lines between theater and film actors. Many of us do both. So break a leg is absolutely a relevant thing to say to a film actor. Seeing Macbeth in a theater, well, how often are you in a theater when you're filming? It doesn't come up as much. But it's definitely out there. It seems to me there was a second part of that question that I intended to answer, and I forgot already.
How seriously do people take these beliefs?
Oh, right. Yes. How serious? Well, it varies. I used to belong to a comedy troupe, as you read in the bio, and we actually used to begin our shows by backstage shouting from the wings, you know, 1, 2, 3, Macbeth, and then we'd come running on stage. And we'd hear gasps from the audience.
Oh, you're hurting people.
Pardon me?
You're hurting people who believe in that kind of thing.
We may be hurting them, but how are we hurting them? We're challenging their perceptions of what reality is, I suppose. And we're you know, pissing on their superstitions, ultimately.
Ultimately.
Yeah, and there were times when we have special guests in the show who would be backstage, and we wouldn't tell them about the Macbeth thing, and there were more than one times when I'd be standing beside the special guest, and we'd be about to go on, and the pre-show music would go off, and we'd go, 1, 2, 3, Macbeth! And the person I'd be standing beside would just get the most horrified look on their face. And I delighted in that. I'm capricious. What can I say?
Capricious. That's what we're going with. Good. So you're fairly open with your skepticism around other industry people then.
Yeah, I don't think anybody, I don't think many people have many illusions about where I stand.
Has it ever gotten in the way?
Not that I know. I mean, I'm open about it, but I try not to, like, when it comes to personal relationships, it's not something I can be a jerk about, but I don't think there's any value in, you know, in poking wounds with people.
Right.
But certainly not when it's a personal connection.
Well, is there actually a skeptical community within the industry then?
Certainly not formalized. You know, you come across people, you cross paths with people occasionally. And like I said, you know, most of the people who I usually find out are skeptically minded are technicians. And, you know, and even the most credulous people, there are plenty of them who, you know, like, oh, yeah, there's, you know, there was a conspiracy within the government to bring down the Twin Towers. But that homeopathy stuff, that's bull crap.
Yes. And everyone has their cognitive dissonance.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so do you guys naturally gravitate towards each other at all? Do you seek out the skeptical other?
I think probably yes. I haven't really measured it, but looking around, I would say that yes, absolutely. In my immediate circle, I tend to just not spend a lot of time with people who are going to tell me, you know, that they, you know, I developed this character by breathing through my sacral center. It's like, yeah, screw you, you did.
I bet you are a barrel of laughs on set.
I make myself laugh.
Okay, so we have another website question. Now, I'm not sure exactly what this person meant. So, what can skeptics do to reach out to actors and writers and producers? I think we're talking about recruiting.
Are we talking about recruiting, or are we talking about... So this is my take on it, is that what can skeptics do to convince actors, writers, directors to bring more or bring less credulism to the work they produce? That's my take on it.
How would you answer it?
How would I answer that? I would say keep watching shows like The Mentalist and Mythbusters, and write letters to the Science Entertainment Exchange and the NAS, and tell them that the Science Entertainment Exchange is a valuable thing. And whenever you see a show where skepticism is presented in a positive way, or science is presented in a positive light, let them know. Give them positive feedback that this is a good thing. I think give them negative feedback when you think they've really done something unnecessarily egregious that goes beyond the bounds of writing a good story in a show. Like, you know, every astronomer in the world hates Armageddon. So,
right.
You know, by all means, go after that. That one's pretty egregious. But, you know, if somebody's just trying to make a good story, then I guess the rule as a writer is to that you get one place where the reality can give. And that can be what you build the story around. You know, there are ghosts, or there are lake monsters, for example. You know, once you've extended beyond that one point of give, then I think you sort of have to start holding the creators responsible for what they're doing.
You know, you get the typical stereotype of the skeptic in the film, right? And actually, there's a website question, another one, relating directly to this. The typical stereotype, the monster doesn't exist right up until the point when they're eaten by the monster. Is it just because it would be boring if it didn't happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. How long in Jaws do we wait to see the shark? And, you know, and that was an accident of production. But the movie is so effective because we don't see the shark for so long. So the tension builds. And yeah, the more you can fear it by not knowing what's going on. Not knowing is one of the scariest things you can imagine, and that's why it takes so long before the monster appears.
And so is the impression of skeptics is that they know, and that's why it's uninteresting?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
You never see a believer convert to a skeptic. It's always the other way around.
Oh, right. You mean in a film?
In a film.
Yeah, no, I don't think I have a good answer for that one, honestly. I think there is a belief that is ultimately a better story arc, and I'm generally speaking going to agree with that, but that's certainly, you know, I would love to see somebody create a satisfying story where it does work the other way. And, you know, it's certainly, you know, in the back of my mind of, okay, I need to figure out a way to make that a great story. I guess there's sort of a structural thing at work here where you need to get bigger. So how do you make what most people are going to see is disappointment of, you know, there isn't really voices talking to you from the other world through the radio. How do you make that be the big exciting finale? I'm not sure that that's going to be easy to do.
That's kind of depressing, though.
It is.
To say that it's boring to have just the idea of someone coming to a rational conclusion about something, that's boring. And I can't say I necessarily agree either, because we have a situation like House.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a hit TV show, and that's what it's all about. So why does that work? Is it just because he's curmudgeonly? Does it make it better?
Yeah, but, you know, nobody shows up to talk to Dr. House saying, oh God, I think I've got a gnome living in my stomach, you know?
Right.
It's all like, oh, you know, like, boy, I'm really tired and I passed out three times last week. So it's already sort of in this world of science. And it's just a question of figuring out what version of reality is the right one in the case of House. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but okay, so how did they manage to make that interesting? And how can we manage to make other, and I say we, like I write or act or something, which I don't, but what can we do to offer maybe a more, I don't know, a more entertaining case study?
Boy, oh boy.
Am I asking you hard questions?
You are, but that's cool, because these are things that I am thinking about already in my world. I haven't come up with perfectly great answers yet.
This is a brainstorming session. I'm helping you.
Absolutely. Public brainstorming. Well, I think what needs to be done, again, it's, you know, my girlfriend laughs at me every time I talk about structure, but it's everything. Structure is everything. It's about finding a setup where the goal is ultimately going to be that we're finding the truth is the good thing to happen. So if you can criminalize the credulousness, I'm actually working on, here's a good example. I'm working on a script for a very early development of on a TV show that I love, and everybody wants to write for the TV shows they love. So I'm writing a spec script for another show where I'm criminalizing psychics. So they are the bad guy. So when it's proven that the psychic in question is jerking people around for money, then that's the win. Because they're suddenly, you know, bam, we've got a case closed. You're a jerk. You're taking advantage of people because they believe in your BS.
Right. But there's a difference between portraying the psychic as a negative as there is portraying the skeptic as a positive. How do we portray skeptics as positives? Like, what kind of skeptical programming do you watch?
Mythbusters is top of my list. Mm-hmm. And I watch House occasionally. Boy, what else? The fact of the matter is, I really use my viewing time as escapism in a major way. So, you know, like, I'm sorry that Battlestar Galactica is off the air and that Lost is following.
I'm still traumatized. We must never speak of the last episode.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
I had to let you down sometime.
No, it's fine.
So, where was I going with that?
Let's change the question. What would your ideal skeptical movie be? It doesn't exist. Make it.
My ideal skeptical...
Who would the nemesis be?
Oh, well, I would definitely go for psychics. Psychics, again, I'm going exactly where you just, where I went before. It's not a new answer, I'm afraid. But psychics burn my tush. Yeah, they were one of the few things, not necessarily few, but they were one of the things in that skeptics rally against that make me the absolute angriest. Oh, well, wait a second. Why would I do that? I would go for what makes me the angry. I'm standing up. I'm the anti-vaccination crowd. I want to make a movie where somebody brings those down.
Okay. And tell me more.
Gosh. I don't know. I'd give you away the plot now. I don't know. It might actually be a dramatization of the Andrew Wakefield story.
Right.
You know, where, I mean, I probably have to create some, boy, oh boy, some sort of amalgam of people who actually, you know, knows that from the start that this guy is full of it and goes after him as evidence mounts further and further that, you know, MMR vaccines are causing autism in kids, and how evil is that, until finally somebody figures it out and has the proof that he has faked his data and gets the son of a bee. You know, that's, I think, okay.
I would see that movie.
Well, we could do a fictionalized account of the same story.
I was going to say, this won't be a comedy.
No.
This is not going to be a comedy.
Well, you know.
So,
but if it could be? What a coup that would be. It's funny and it's got this hard-hitting... I don't know. I'm just...
Oh, you mean it's Canadian.
Now. It's Canadian, yeah.
Exactly. So, okay, so I and a number of other people were lucky enough to be a part of this exclusive test screening at TAM. How can other people see the film?
Well, I wish I had a bit better answer than I do. We are currently waiting on the announcement of the Vancouver Film Festival. And if we are accepted, then, and that will be, I think it goes, the public announcement is September 12th, if I'm not mistaken, so it's coming up fairly soon. That will be the premiere, hopefully, knock on, how unskeptical is that? Knock on wood.
It's okay, I say cross my fingers all the time.
So that would be that's sort of my preferred answer at this point, but I have no control over that. If people want to get information, they should just go to our blog, because we will put the information up there as to where it's premiering, and then further down the road, where it's going to be, how it's being distributed, and where you can get a DVD, and that sort of information as it becomes available.
So why don't we just give everybody the website addresses now? You can visit the show blog at ogopogomovie.blogspot.com.
Right.
Or if you were enjoying Kennedy's antics on the show today, you can visit his personal blog at assholeskeptic.blogspot.com. ASSHOLE skeptic@blogspot.com. Is that right?
That sounded right to me.
Thanks so much, Kennedy, for being on the show today. That was lovely.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime.
So if you'd like to subscribe to Skeptically Speaking or be our Facebook friend or follow us on Twitter, visit our website at skepticallyspeaking.com and you'll see links to all the ways you can show your love. And thanks to Mike for pre-production work and Jarrett for the post-production work on this week's show, and have fun with all the swears. We'll be back next week with Richard Saunders, paranormal researcher and host of the podcast The Skeptic Zone. And he'll be speaking at DragonCon this weekend, so he'll have some great stories to tell. See you then on Skeptically Speaking.
Sometimes fall up, but you never see, and everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. Oh, the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie. it's been years,
but I've never loved you,
and I never will,
though I've tried.
We'll never get married.
I'm dating your sister, and everything you believe is a lie. Lie.